to join us for lunch. One afternoon, I asked him about his project. "Let me peek," I begged. "I won't tell anyone anything until it's done." But Thomas shook his head.
"It'll be worth the wait," he promised.
"I could help you. I'm good at painting."
"You're good at a lot of things," Thomas said, and he kissed me.
We had been having a lot of sex. After Jenna went to sleep, Thomas would come back from the African barn and shower, then slip into bed beside me. Our lovemaking was almost desperate. If I was trying to escape the memory of Mora's calf, Thomas seemed to be trying to keep himself tethered to something. It was almost as if I didn't matter, as if any body beneath him would have done the job. But I couldn't place blame, since I was using Thomas, too, to forget. I'd fall asleep, exhausted, and in the middle of the night, when my hand inched across the sheets to find him, he would be gone again. At first, on the picnic, I kissed him back. But then his hand slid under my shirt, fumbling with the clasp of my bra. "Thomas," I whispered. "We're in public." Not only were we sitting in the shadow of the African barn, where any of the employees might pass by, but Jenna was staring at us. She pulled herself to her feet and stumbled toward us, a tiny zombie. I gasped, "Thomas, she's walking!" His face was buried in the curve of my neck. His hand covered my breast. "Thomas," I said, shoving him away. "Look!" He backed off, annoyed. His eyes were nearly black behind his glasses, and even though he didn't say anything, I could hear him clearly. "How dare you!" But then Jenna tumbled into his lap, and he scooped her up and kissed her forehead and each cheek.
"What a big girl,"
he said, as Jenna babbled against his shoulder. He set her down on the ground, pointing her in my direction.
"Was it a fluke or a new skill?" he asked. "Should we run the experiment again?"
I laughed. This girl is doomed, having two scientists as parents. I held out my arms. "Come back to me," I coaxed. I was speaking to my daughter, but I might as well have been pleading to Thomas as well. A few days later, when I was helping Grace prepare meals for the Asian elephants, I asked her if she ever argued with Gideon. "Why?" she said, suddenly guarded. "It just seems like you get along so well," I replied. "It's a little daunting." Grace relaxed. "He doesn't put the toilet seat down. Drives me crazy." "If that's his only flaw, I'd say you're incredibly lucky." I raised a cleaver, chopping a melon in half, focusing my attention on the juice that bled out of it. "Does he ever keep secrets from you?"
"Like what he's getting me for my birthday?"
she shrugged.
"Sure."
"I don't mean those kinds of secrets. I mean the kind that make you think he's hiding something." I put down the knife and looked her in the eye. "The night the calf died, you saw Thomas in his office, didn't you?" We had never talked about it, but I knew Grace must have seen him, rocking back and forth in his chair, his eyes empty, his hands shaking. I knew that was why she had refused to leave Jenna alone with him. Grace's gaze slid away from mine. "Everyone's got their demons," she murmured. I knew from the way she said it that this was not the first time she had seen Thomas that way. "It's happened before?"
"He always bounces back."
Was I the only person at the sanctuary who didn't know? "He told me it was just once, after his parents died," I said, my face hot. "I thought marriage was a partnership, you know? For better or for worse, in sickness and in health. Why would he lie to me?
Keeping a secret isn't always lying. Sometimes it's the only way to protect the person you love.
I scoffed. You only say that because you haven't been on the receiving end.
No, Grace said softly, but I've been the one who keeps the secret.
She began to shovel peanut butter into the empty bellies of the halved melons, her hands quick and practiced.
I love taking care of your daughter, she added, a non sequitur.
I know, I'm grateful.
I love taking care of your daughter, Grace repeated, because I'm never going to have one of my own.
I looked at her, and in that moment she reminded me of Mora. There was a shadow in her eyes that I'd noticed before, that I'd chalked up to youth and insecurity, but that actually may have been the loss of something she never really had.
You're still young, I said.
Grace shook her head.
I have PCOS, she clarified. It's a hormone thing.
You could get a surrogate. You could adopt. Have you talked to Gideon about the alternatives? She just stared at me, and I understood. Gideon didn't know. This was the secret she had been keeping from him. Suddenly, Grace grabbed my arm so tightly that it hurt.
You won't tell?
No, I promised. She settled, picking up her knife again to start cutting. We worked in silence for a few moments, and then Grace spoke again.
It's not that he doesn't love you enough to tell you the truth, she said. It's that he loves you too much to risk it.
That night, after Thomas slipped into the cottage after midnight, I pretended to be asleep when he poked his head into the bedroom. I waited until I heard the shower running, and then I got out of bed and walked out of the cottage, careful not to wake Jenna. In the dark, as my eyes adjusted, I ran past Grace and Gideon's cottage where the lights were off. I thought of them twined together in bed, with an infinitesimal space between them at every point they touched. The spiral staircase was painted black, and I banged my shin against it before I realized I had already reached the far edge of the African barn. Moving silently, I didn't want to wake the elephants and have them send out an inadvertent alert. I crept up the stairs, biting my lip against the pane. At the top, the door was locked, but one master key opened everything at the sanctuary, so I knew I'd be able to get inside. The first thing I noticed was that, as Thomas had said, the moonlit view was remarkable. Although Thomas hadn't installed the plate glass windows, he had cut out rough openings and covered them with a sheet of clear plastic. Through them, I could see every acre of the sanctuary, illuminated by the grace of the full moon. I could easily imagine a viewing platform, an observatory, a way for the public to see the amazing animals we sheltered without us having to disturb their natural habitat or make them part of a display like they'd been in zoos and circuses. Maybe I was overreacting. Maybe Thomas was just trying to do what he'd said. Save his business. I turned, feeling along the wall until I could locate the light switch. The room flooded, so bright that for a moment I couldn't see. The space was empty. There was no furniture, no boxes, no tools, not even a stick of wood. The walls had been painted a blinding white, along with the ceiling and the floor. But scrawled on every inch were letters and numbers written over and over in a looping code. C-14, H-19, N-04, C-18, H-16, N-6, S-2, C-16, H-21, N-02, C-3, H-6, N-2, O-2, C-189, H-285, N-55, O-57, S. It was like walking into a church and finding occult symbols written in blood on the walls. My breath caught in my throat. The room was closing in on me, the numbers shimmering and blending into each other. I realized, as I sank down onto the floor, this was because I was crying. Thomas was sick. Thomas needed help. And although I was not a psychiatrist, although I didn't have experience with any of this, it did not look like depression to me. It just looked crazy. I stood up and backed out of the room, keeping the door unlocked. I didn't have much time, but instead of going to our cottage, I went to the one shared by Gideon and Grace and knocked on the door. Grace answered, wearing a man's t-shirt, her hair tousled.
"Alice," she said, "what's wrong?"
"My husband is mentally ill. This sanctuary is dying. Maura lost her calf."
"You pick."
"Is Gideon here?" I asked, when I knew that he was. Not everyone had a husband who sneaked off in the middle of the night to write gibberish on the ceiling and floor and walls of an empty room. He came to the door in a pair of shorts, his torso bare, a shirt in hand. "I need your help," I said.
"One of the elephants? Is something wrong?"
I didn't answer, just turned on my heel and started to walk toward the African barn again. Gideon fell into step beside me, pulling the t-shirt over his head.
"Which girl is it?"
"The elephants are fine," I said, my voice shaking. We had reached the base of the spiral staircase. "I need you to do something, and I need you to not ask me any questions. Can you handle that?" Gideon took one look at my face and nodded. I climbed as if I were headed to my own execution. In retrospect, maybe I was. Maybe this was the first step to a long and fatal fall. I opened the door so that Gideon could see the interior.
"Holy shit," he breathed. "What is this?"
"I don't know, but you have to paint over it before morning." Just like that, the threads of self-restraint snapped, and I doubled over, unable to breathe, unable to stem the tears anymore. Gideon immediately reached for me, but I backed away. "Hurry," I choked out, and I ran down the stairs, back to my cottage, where I found Thomas just opening the door of the bathroom, a cloud of steam haloing his body.
"Did I wake you?"
he asked, and he smiled, that crooked smile that had made me hang on his words in Africa, that I saw whenever I closed my eyes. If I had any chance of saving Thomas from himself, then I had to make him believe I wasn't the enemy. I had to make him believe that I believed in him. So I pasted what I hoped was a similar smile on my face. "I thought I heard Jenna cry."
"Is she all right?"
"Fast asleep," I told Thomas, swallowing around the wishbone of truth caught in my throat. "It must have been a nightmare." I had lied to Gideon when he asked what was written on the wall. I did know. It wasn't a random string of letters and numbers. It was chemical formulas for drugs. An isomycin, U0126, propanolol, D-cycloserine, and neuropeptide Y. I had written about them in an earlier paper when I was trying to find links between elephant memory and cognition. These were compounds that, if given quickly after a trauma, interacted with the amygdala to keep a memory from being coded as painful or upsetting. Using rats, scientists had successfully been able to eliminate the stress and fear caused by certain memories. You can imagine the implications for that. And recently, some medical professionals had. Controversies had sprung up around hospitals that wanted to administer drugs like this to rape victims. beyond the practical issue of whether or not the blocked memory actually would stay blocked forever, there was a moral issue. Could a traumatized victim actually give permission to be given the drug if by definition she was traumatized and unable to think clearly? What had Thomas been doing with my paper, and how did it tie in to plans to raise money for the sanctuary? But then maybe it didn't. If Thomas truly had snapped, he might see relevance in the clues of a crossword puzzle. He might see meaning in the weatherman's forecast. He would be constructing a reality full of causal links that were, to the rest of us, unrelated. It had been a long time, but the conclusion of my paper was that there was a reason the brain had evolved in a way that allowed a memory to be red-flagged. If memories protected us from future dangerous situations, was it in our best interest to chemically forget them? Would I ever unsee that room, looped with the graffiti of chemical formulas? No, not even after Gideon had painted it white again. And maybe that was for the best, because it reminded me that the man I thought I had fallen in love with was not the one who came into the kitchen this morning, whistling. I had plans. I wanted to get Thomas help, but no sooner had he left for the observation deck than Nevi showed up with Grace.
"I need your help moving Hester,"
Nevi said, and I remembered that I'd promised her we could try to put the two African elephants together today. I could have postponed it, but then Nevi would have asked why, and I didn't feel like talking about last night. Grace held out her arms for Jenna, and I thought about our conversation yesterday. "Did Gideon..." I began. "He finished," she said, and that was all I needed to know. I followed Nevi out to the African enclosures, peeking at the upstairs level of the barn with its sheet of plastic and the overpowering smell of fresh paint. Was Thomas in there, even now? Was he angry to find his handiwork destroyed? Devastated? Indifferent? Did he suspect me of doing it?
"Where are you today?" Nevi asked. "I asked you a question."
"Sorry, I didn't sleep well last night. Do you want to take down the fence or drive her forward?" "I'll get the gate," I said. We had built a hot wire fence to separate Hester from Mora when we realized Mora was pregnant. To tell the truth, if either elephant had wanted to get to the other side, she could have easily torn it down, but these two had not been together long enough to bond before they were separated. They were acquaintances, not friends. They had no great affection for each other yet, which is why I didn't think Nevi's idea was going to work. In Tswana, there is a saying, "Ho oramoto, ha holewe." Where there is support, there is no grief. You see this in the wild, when elephants mourn the death of a herd member. After a while, a few elephants will peel off to go to a watering hole. Others will investigate the brush for sustenance. It comes down to one or two elephants left behind, usually the daughters or young sons of the fallen elephant, who are reluctant to resume their daily lives. But the herd always comes back for them. It may be en masse, it may be just an emissary or two. They vocalize with "let's go" rumbles and angle their bodies to encourage the mourning elephants to join them. Eventually, they all do. But Hester was not Mora's cousin or sister. She was just another elephant. Mora had no incentive to listen to her, no more than I might have followed a complete stranger who walked up to me and suggested we go to lunch. While Nevi drove off in the ATV in search of Hester, I disconnected the fence controller and unwound the wire, creating an open gate. I waited until I heard the engine revving and spotted the elephant following Nevi placidly. She was a sucker for watermelon, and there was a whole one on the ATV for her that would be placed closer to Mora. I hopped on the vehicle as we drove to the site of the calf's grave, where Mora still stood, her shoulders sloped, and her trunk dragging on the ground. Nevi cut the engine, and I hopped off, setting the food for Hester a distance away from Mora. We had brought a treat for Mora, too, but unlike Hester, she did not touch hers. Hester speared the watermelon on her tusk and let the juice drip into her mouth. Then she curled her trunk around the melon, plucked it from the ivory skewer, and crushed it between her jaws. Mora did not acknowledge her presence, but I could see her spine stiffen at the sound made by Hester's crunching. "Nevi," I said quietly, climbing onto the ATV again. "Turn on the engine." Lightning fast, Mora pivoted and thundered toward Hester, her head shaking and her ears flapping. Dirt chuffed, a cloud of intimidation. Hester squealed and threw back her trunk, just as willing to stand her ground. "Go," I said, and Nevi angled the ATV so that Hester was headed off before she could get close to Mora. Mora didn't even turn toward us as we shepherded Hester away to the other side of the hot wire fence. She faced the raw, dark grave of the calf, which stretched like a yawn across the earth. Sweating, my heart still pounding from the confrontation, I let Nevi lead Hester deeper into the African enclosure while I reaffixed the wire joints, crimped them closed, and reattached the battery clamps. Nevi drove up again a few minutes later as I was finishing. "Well," I said, "I told you so." I took advantage of the fact that Grace was still watching Jenna and stopped off at the African barn to talk to Thomas. Climbing the spiral staircase, I heard no sound from inside the space. It made me wonder if Thomas had found the whitewashed walls and if that had been enough to snap him back to equilibrium. But when I reached the door, the knob turned in my hand, and I stepped into the room to find one wall entirely covered with the same symbols I'd seen last night, and another wall half-finished. Thomas stood on a chair, writing so furiously I thought the plaster might burst into flame. I felt as if my skeleton had turned to stone. "Thomas," I said, "I think we need to talk." He glanced over his shoulder, so absorbed in his work that he hadn't even heard me come in. He didn't seem embarrassed or surprised, just disappointed.
"It was going to be a surprise," he said. "I was doing it for you."
"Doing what?" He stepped off the chair.
"It's called molecular consolidation theory. It's been proven that memories stay in an elastic state before they are chemically encoded by the brain. Disturb that process, and you can alter the way the memory is recalled. To date, the only scientific successes have occurred when the inhibitors are given immediately after the trauma. But let's say the trauma's already passed. What if we could regress the mind back to that moment and give the drug? Would the trauma be forgotten?"
I stared at him, completely lost. "That's not possible."
"It is if you can go back in time."
"What?" He rolled his eyes.
"I'm not building a TARDIS, a time machine," Thomas said. "That would be insane."
"Insane," I repeated, the word breaking on the jetty of a sob.
"It's not literal bending of the fourth dimension, but you can alter perception for an individual so that time is effectively reversed. You take them back to the stress through an altered consciousness and have them re-experience the emotional trauma long enough for the drug to do its job. And here's the part that's a surprise for you. Mora. She's going to be the subject."
At the sound of the elephant's name, my gaze snapped to his.
"You aren't touching Mora." "Not even if I can fix her? If I can make her forget her calf's death?"
I shook my head. It doesn't work that way, Thomas.
But what if it did? What if there were implications for humans? Imagine the work that could be done with veterans who suffer from PTSD. Imagine if the sanctuary cemented its name as a critical research facility. We could get seed money from the Center for Neural Science at NYU. And if they agree to partner with me, the media attention could bring in investors to offset the loss of revenue the calf had been projected to bring in. I could win a Nobel!
I swallowed. What makes you think you can regress a mind?
I was told I could.
By whom? He reached into his back pocket and took out a piece of paper with the letterhead of the sanctuary at the top. Written on it was a phone number I recognized. I had called it last week when my credit card was declined at Gordon's. Welcome to Citibank MasterCard. Beneath the customer service hotline number was a list of anagrams for the words account balance. Cabal cannot queue. Banal seek account. Accentual bacon. Kabbalah wants cunt. Canal beacon cut. Cab unclean coat. Lacuna ant bocce. Nebula coca cant. A cab nuance clot. A cab cannot clue. A cable can count. A conceal can but. Cabal can't cue on. Anal acne cub cot. Ban ocean lack cut. Cabal act once new. Actual can be con. The last words were circled so deeply that the paper had begun to disintegrate.
You see? It's in code. Actual can be con.
Thomas's eyes burned into mine as if he were explaining the meaning of life.
What you see is not what you believe.
I stepped toward him until we were standing only inches apart. Thomas, I whispered, holding my palm up to his cheek. Baby, you're sick. He grasped my hand, a lifeline. Until then, I hadn't realized how hard I was trembling.
Damn right I'm sick,
he muttered, squeezing so hard that I twisted in pain.
I'm sick of you doubting me.
He leaned so close that I could see the ring of orange around his pupils and the pulse in his temple.
I am doing this for you,
he said. Biting off each word, spitting them in my face. I'm doing this for you too, I cried. And I ran out of the airless room and down the spiral stairs. Dartmouth College was 65 miles south. They had a state-of-the-art hospital there, and it happened to have the closest inpatient psychiatric facility to Boone. I didn't know what made the psychiatrist agree to see me, considering I did not have an appointment and there was a waiting room full of people with equally pressing issues. All I could think, as I clutched Jenna against me and sat across from Dr. Thibodeau, was that the receptionist must have taken one look at me and thought I was feeding her a line. Husband my ass, she probably thought, staring at my wrinkled uniform, my unwashed hair. My crying baby. She's the one who's in crisis. I had spent a half hour telling the doctor what I knew of Thomas's history and what I had seen last night. I think the pressure has broken him, I said. Out loud, the words swelled like garish balloons. They took up all the space in the room.
It's possible that what you're describing are symptoms of mania. The doctor said. It's part of bipolar illness, which we used to call manic depressive disorder.
He smiled at me.
Being bipolar is like being forced to take LSD. It means your sensations and emotions and creativity are at their peak, but also that the highs are higher and the lows are lower. You know what they say. If a manic does something bizarre and it turns out to be right, he's brilliant. If it turns out to be wrong, he's crazy.
Dr. Thibodeau smiled at Jenna, who was gumming one of his paperweights.
The good news is, if that's what's actually going on with your husband, it's treatable. The medications we put people on to control these mood swings bring them back to center. When Thomas realizes that he's living not a reality, but just a manic episode, he's going to swing in the other direction and get very depressed because he isn't the man he thought he was.
That makes two of us, I thought.
Has your husband harmed you?
I thought of the moment he grabbed my hand, how I heard the crunch of bones and cried out. No, I said. I had betrayed Thomas enough. I would not do this too.
Do you think he might?
I stared down at Jenna. I don't know.
He needs to be evaluated by a psychiatrist. If it is bipolar disorder, he may need time in the hospital to be stabilized.
Hopeful, I glanced at the doctor. So you can bring him here?
No,
Dr. Thibodeau said.
Institutionalizing someone is a stripping of personal rights. We can't take him by force unless he's hurt you.
Then what am I supposed to do? I asked. The doctor met my gaze.
You're going to have to convince him to come in voluntarily.
He gave me his card and told me to call him when I felt Thomas was ready to become an inpatient. During the drive back to Boone, I thought about what I could possibly say to convince Thomas to go to the hospital in Lebanon. I could tell him Jenna was sick, but then why wouldn't we go to her pediatrician, one town over? Even if I said I'd found him a donor or a neuroscientist interested in his experiment, it would only get him in the door. The minute we checked in at the psychiatric reception desk, he'd know what I was actually doing. I came to the conclusion that the only way to get Thomas to voluntarily check into a psychiatric ward was to make him see, simply and honestly, that this was best for him, that I still loved him, that we were in this together. Fortified, I drove into the sanctuary, parked at the cottage, and carried a sleepy Jenna inside. I settled her on the couch and then went back to close the door I'd left ajar. When Thomas grabbed me from behind, I screamed. "You scared me," I said, turning in his arms, trying to read his expression.
"I thought you left me. I thought you took Jenna and that you weren't coming back."
I ran my hand through his hair. "No," I swore. "I would never." When he kissed me, it was with the desperation of a man who is trying to save himself. When he kissed me, I believed that Thomas was going to be fine. I believed that maybe I would never have to call Dr. Thibodeau, that this was the beginning of Thomas's sway to center. I told myself that I could believe all of this, no matter how unfounded or unlikely, without realizing how much that made me like Thomas. There is something else about memory, something Thomas hadn't brought up. It's not a video recording. It's subjective. It's a culturally relevant account of what happened. It doesn't matter if it's accurate. It matters if it's important in some way to you, if it teaches you something you need to learn. For a few months, it seemed as if life at the sanctuary was settling back to normal. Maura took extended walks away from her calf's grave before returning to settle down there each night. Thomas began to work in his home office again instead of constructing the observation deck. We left it locked and boarded up like a ghost village. A grant he'd written for funding months ago came in unexpectedly, giving us a little breathing room for supplies and salaries. I began to compare my notes about Maura and her grief to those about the other elephant mothers I'd seen lose calves. I spent hours walking with Jenna at a toddler's pace. I pointed to wildflowers by color to teach her new words. Thomas and I argued about whether it was safe for her in the enclosures. I loved those arguments, for their simplicity, their sanity. One lazy afternoon, when Grace was sitting for Jenna in the stagnant heat, I was doing a trunk wash in the Asian barn with Dion. We trained the elephants in this behavior so that we could test for TB. We'd fill a syringe with saline, flush it into a nostril, and get the elephant to lift her trunk as high as possible. Then we'd hold a gallon-sized Ziploc bag over the trunk as she lowered it and the fluid drained out. The sample was collected in a container and sent off to the lab. Some elephants hated the process. Dion was one of the easier ones. So perhaps my guard was down, and that's why I didn't notice Thomas suddenly striding into the barn. He grabbed me by the neck, dragging me away from the elephant so that she couldn't reach us through the metal bars.
"Who's Thibodeau?"
Thomas yelled, smacking my head against the steel so hard that my vision blurred. I honestly didn't know what he was talking about.
"Thibodeau," Thomas repeated. "You must know. His card was in your wallet."
His hand was a vice around my throat. My lungs felt like they were on fire. I clawed at his fingers, at his wrists. He pressed a small white rectangle close to my face.
"Ring a bell?"
I could barely see anything but stars at the edges of my vision. Still, somehow, I was able to make out the logo for the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Hospital. The psychiatrist I'd seen, the one who had given me his card.
"You want to lock me away," Thomas accused. "You're trying to steal my research. You've probably already called NYU to take credit, but the joke's on you, Alice, because you don't have the code to dial into the colloquium's private conference line, and not knowing that flags you as an imposter."
Dion was bellowing, crashing against the reinforced bars of the barn. I tried to explain. I tried to speak. Thomas slammed me harder against the steel, and my eyes rolled upward. Suddenly, there was air and light, and I was falling to the cement floor, gasping as my chest filled with fire. I rolled to my side to see Gideon punching Thomas so hard that his head arced backward and blood bloomed from his nose and mouth. I scrambled to my feet and ran out of the barn. I did not get very far before my legs gave out beneath me, but to my surprise, I didn't fall. I wound up caught in Gideon's arms. He stared at my throat, touched a finger to the red necklace made by Thomas's hands. He was so gentle, like silk over a scar, that something inside me snapped.
I shoved at him. "I didn't ask for your help."
He let go of me, surprised. I staggered away from him, avoiding the spot where I knew Grace had taken Jenna swimming, and made my way to the cottage. I went right to Thomas's office, where he had been spending his time keeping the books and updating the files of the individual elephants. On his desk was a ledger we used to record all our income and expenses. I sat down and flipped through the first few pages, marking the deliveries of hay and the payments for veterinary care, the lab bills, and the produce contract. Then I skipped to the end. C-14, H-19, N-04, C-18, H-16, N-6, S-2, C-16, H-21, N-02, C-3, H-6, N-2, O-2, C-189, H-285, N-55, O-57, S. C-14, H-19, N-04, C-18, H-16, N-6, S2, C16, H21, NO2, C3, H6, N2, O2, C189, H285, N55, O57, S. C14, H19, NO4, C18, H16, N6, S2, C16, H21, NO2, C3, H6, N2, O2, C189, H285, N55, O57, S. I put my head down on the desk and cried. I wrapped a gauzy blue scarf around my neck and went to sit with Mora near the calf's grave. I had been there for maybe an hour when Thomas approached on foot. He stood on the other side of the fence, hands in his pockets.
"I just wanted to tell you I'm going away for a while," he said. "It's somewhere I've been before. They can help me."
I didn't look at him. "I think that's a good idea."
"I left the contact information on the kitchen counter, but they won't let you talk to me. It's part of the way they do things."
I did not think I'd need Thomas while he was gone. We had been running this sanctuary in his absence, even when he had been on the premises.
"Tell Jenna."
He shook his head.
"Well, don't tell Jenna anything except that I love her."
Thomas took a step forward.
"I know it's not worth much, but I'm sorry. I'm not me right now. That's not an excuse. But it's all I have."
I didn't watch him leave. I sat with my arms wrapped tight around my legs. 20 feet away, Mora picked up a fallen branch with a paintbrush of pine needles at the end and began to sweep the ground in front of her. She did this for several minutes and then started to walk away from the grave. After moving a few yards, she turned and looked at me. Then she walked a bit and paused, waiting. I got to my feet and followed. It was humid. My clothes stuck to my skin. I couldn't speak. My throat hurt that bad. The ends of the scarf I wore moved like butterflies on my shoulders in the hot breath of the breeze. Mora moved slowly and deliberately until she reached the hot wire fence. In the distance, on the far side, she stared longingly at the pond. I didn't have tools or gloves. I didn't have anything I needed to disable the electric fence. But I pried the box open with my fingernails and disengaged the batteries. I used all my strength to untie the makeshift gate I'd wired weeks before, even though the wire bit into my fingers and my hands grew slick with blood. Then I dragged the fence open so that Mora could walk through. She did, but paused at the edge of the pond. "We didn't come all this way for nothing."
"Let's go," I rasped, and I kicked off my shoes and waded into the water.
It was cold and clear, deliciously fresh. My shirt and scarf stuck to my skin, and my shorts ballooned around my thighs. I ducked underwater, letting my hair fall out of its ponytail, and resurfaced, kicking to stay afloat. Then I flicked a handful of water at Mora. She took 2 steps back and then reached her trunk into the pond and sprayed a stream over my head like a rain shower. Her movement was so calculated, so unexpected, and so playful after weeks of despair that I laughed out loud. It didn't sound like my voice. It was stripped and ragged, but it was joy. Mora gingerly waded into the pool, rolling to her left side and then to her right, tossing a spray of water over her back and then over me again. It reminded me of the herd I had taken Thomas to watch in the waterhole in Botswana, back when I thought my life would be different than it had turned out to be. I watched Mora splash and roll, buoyed by the water, lighter than she'd been in a long time, and very slowly I let myself float, too.
"She's playing,"
Gideon said from the far bank.
"That means she's letting go."
I had not realized he was here. I had not known we were being watched. I owed Gideon an apology. I had not asked to be rescued, true, but that did not mean I didn't need saving. I felt silly, unprofessional. Swimming across the pool, I left Mora to her own devices and emerged dripping, unsure of what to say. "I'm sorry," I offered. "I shouldn't have said what I said to you."
"How are you?"
Gideon asked, concerned. I paused, because I didn't know the answer. Relieved? Nervous? Scared? Then I smiled a little.
"Wet."
Gideon grinned, taking my cue. He held out his empty hands.
"I don't have a towel."
I didn't know I would be swimming. Mora seemed to need a little encouragement. He held my gaze.
"Maybe she just needed to know someone was there for her."
I stared at him until Mora sprayed us both with a fine mist. Gideon jumped away from the stream of cold water, but to me, it felt like a baptism, like starting over. That night, I called a staff meeting. I told Nevi and Grace and Gideon that Thomas would be visiting investors abroad for a while and that we would have to run the sanctuary without him. I could tell none of them believed me, but they pitied me enough to pretend. I gave Jenna ice cream for dinner, just because, and put her to sleep in my bed. Then I went to the bathroom and unwound the scarf from my neck, where it had dried in wrinkles after my swim with Mora. There was a string of fingerprints, dark as South Sea pearls, wringing my throat. A bruise is how the body remembers it's been wronged. Padding down the hall in the dark, I found the post-it note that Thomas had left in the kitchen. "Morgan House," he had printed, in his linear, architectural handwriting. "Stowe, Vermont, 802-555-6868. I picked up the phone and dialed. I didn't need to talk to him, but I did want to know that he'd gotten there safely, that he was going to be all right. "The number you have dialed is no longer..."